accession number 28452, reel 1.
I can't really remember. Right, here we go. Tony Porter, reel 1. If I could ask you, first of all, Mrs. Porter, to tell me something about your life before the war. Could you tell me when you were born and whereabouts you were born and brought up?
I was born on April the 1st, 1925, and born in Southampton, and promptly went, because my father had a job in America, to America, and came back at the Wall Street crash after he lost his job in America, because he worked for a politician. He was an estate manager in Virginia. And we came back on the Mauritania, which I have a photograph of, which I'm just looking at, of me in my Charles Lindbergh suit.
Oh, I can see that.
All little children had Charles Lindbergh suits, and it was maroon leather, and it had jodhpurs, and it was rather sweet. And we came back, and I grew up in various places because my mother and father, unhappily, were divorced. And my mother married again, and my stepfather was with an oil company and went about all over the country. So we lived in Sussex and Surrey mainly. And I went to school in Chertsey at Sir William Perkins, from whence I left when I was 17, and came home and made a nuisance of myself to my mother, who said to me, well, I think you should get a job. And we knew a test pilot at Fair Oaks Aerodrome at Chobham, and he said, oh, well, we'll give Tony a job doing something with the aircraft, because she likes aircraft. And I was always interested in aircraft, so I went to Chobham and learned how to rivet holes in aircraft, and did that, and wore a white boiler suit and thought myself very glamorous, I can tell you. And I've shown you a thing of my riveting. I've shown you that, and you've seen that I was a very good rivet.
Well, indeed, it's most impressive and very accurate, very pretty, actually.
But in the meantime, I wanted to join the Wrens, and my mother wouldn't let me. And in the end, I made such a nonsense of myself at home that she said, oh, well, damn well, join the Wrens then. And she signed the papers, because I was still only 17 and a half by this time. And I was called up when I was just 1 month over 18.
Well, I want to hear an awful lot about your Wrens and experience, but would you mind very much if I go back to the earlier time?
Not at all.
When the war was breaking out, or really the threat of war, do you remember much about that? You would have been at school then, I
was at school, and I do remember it very well. I remember the day France fell, and the girls came out into the corridors, and there was a lot of hushed talk, and somebody said, France has fallen. And I can still remember the shiver that went down my back, because I thought, if France has fallen, we've only got the Channel. And I was quite alarmed. And that would have been in 1940, about the time of Dunkirk, I suppose. I suppose I was 15, something like that. Yes.
Yes. Did it mean much to you, you know, when the war actually started?
I kept a diary of the war, which I no longer have, unfortunately, a big diary, and I charted our process through the war, really, until I joined the Wrens, and then I stopped doing it, which was rather a shame. Yes.
Yes. So
I was very interested in the war.
Yes. Were you affected at all by the Blitz, you know, after the fall of France?
No, because I lived in Old Woking, and we only had one bomb and one landmine over Woking. But we could see the fires of London burning brightly from there. We could see this big red glow in the sky. And we had friends who lived in Chelsea who used to come out and spend the night with us when the bombing got really bad, which was quite interesting. Yes, I remember the war very well. Yes.
Because you would have been a teenager, wouldn't
you?
I was
14 when it started.
Yes. All your teens would have been. Well, I suppose the latter part would have been in the Wrens.
Until I joined the Wrens.
Taken
yes.
us through to that. Mm. Yes. But did it affect your life much, the war? You know, apart from the fact that, you know, things like the fall of France and this fear of invasion. But I'm wondering, as a teenager, when you look back, do you think life was very different for a teenager in wartime? then...
I don't really think it was. I think we went about our normal things. I mean, I lived in Old Woking and I went to school in Chertsey, which demanded a train to Weybridge and another train to Chertsey. And I went every day and came back every day and nothing happened at all, except that on one occasion, three aircraft came in to bomb Vickers. And one of our girls, a girl called Barbara Arkell, who was very clever, was killed. And that was something I remember very well indeed. And I still think about Barbara Arkell because she was such a clever girl. And she was killed in this really one-off raid. You know, it was quite extraordinary because, of course, we were near Vickers. Being in Chertsey, we were near Vickers at Weybridge. But I don't remember ever having the trains held up. I don't remember ever having any problem getting to and from school. Not at all. You know, things just went on as normal. Of course, there was rationing. But that didn't really affect me very much.
And I suppose, really, during the 1930s and early 1940s, teenage years were rather different from what they are today. Is that right?
You know? Well, we certainly didn't have the freedom that children have today. No, we didn't. We were... I mean, we had to be in the evening because of possible action. You never knew when a stray bomb was going to hit on your village or your town. And we didn't have the children. My grandchildren today have such freedom. They have their own cars at 18 and they whiz about the countryside. And I think, what a difference, really. And yet they're still the same sort of nice young people, I think, that we were. My children have brought their children up quite strictly and they have turned into very nice children. The kind of children who get up and give their seats to the elderly on tubes and buses, which is rather nice.
Yes, it'd be interesting later on, you know, the responsibility you had at 18,
yes,
which possibly your grandchildren don't have.
No,
you know,
not at all.
This is the other
no.
side of it, isn't
no.
it?
Mm. The worst thing for them is going so far away to university. I've got one at Trinity Dublin and one in Cardiff, and a little boy who's 13 in September who's going to Eton in September, which is rather fascinating. Much better education than his father had, I can assure you.
Right, so going back to your leaving school and wanting to, you know, do something and ending up as a riveter, you know, during your sort of war work period, as it were, what sort of place were you working in then? Could you tell me more about
well,
it?
Well, Fair Oaks was quite a big aerodrome which had a lot of tiger moths. But while I was there, I did see the first mosquito aircraft under wraps, which was in a hangar, and we were all allowed to go and lift the tarpaulin and have a look at this plane, which was made of wood. As you probably know, the mosquito was made of wood. And, of course, the mosquito figured large in my life later because I married into the Air Force after the war was over, and my husband was killed in a mosquito flying over the Channel on night exercises. So I wasn't to know what a part the mosquito was going to play in my life at that stage, but I did see it, and it was very hush-hush, very secret.
How many women would have been working as riveters?
Not many, mostly men. Only about three or four girls, really.
And what sort of training did you have? Do you remember the sort of quality
yes,
of it?
I do. I was trained how to cut metal and fit metal to holes, and eventually, after training, which took about 2 months, the training, able to put patches on aircraft that had been shot at, which was, I remember one particular one, a Blenheim. We put a patch on a Blenheim, but I don't remember the names of the other aircraft really at all.
Yes, one's seen pictures of riveters, and I have this image of you in your lovely white
my white boiler
overalls.
Suit. Yes.
Did you have to wear these protective things over
no,
your face?
No, we didn't. Quite extraordinary, but we didn't. No. And there didn't seem to be any mass security either. It was, we just went to the aerodrome, did our work, and came home. Our life was a lot more laid back, even with a war going on, really, than it is today. I mean, today we have a lot of security all over the place, as you know.
Did you experience any sexism at that time, do you think, with the men?
Well, boys used to whistle at us, we three or four girls, and we took it as a great compliment. We never thought of sexual harassment. We thought, oh boy, we must look good, they're whistling at us. No, there was nothing like that at all.
No, not
just men showing their appreciation of a pretty girl, really.
Yes. I was wondering about, you know, the job you were doing and whether there was any sort of complaint. Can women do that job?
None at all.
Can we rely
on them? None at all, no.
Because it was a responsible job, wasn't it?
Well, it was
quite. You were patching up some aircraft.
Yes.
After all, if they flew and your rivets hadn't been good,
no.
Presumably there could have been accidents.
We also learned how to put something that I think was called skin and dope on tiger moths that had holes in them. And because tiger moths were really made of fabric stretched over a frame, and they were sort of canvas and this dope stuff that you applied, which smelled terrible. It really got in your nose and was awful. But we did a bit of that as well in our spare time.
So how old would you be when you started doing that job?
17 and a bit. Yes, just after I left school.
But you weren't happy with staying there, you didn't think, or your mother wasn't happy?
Well, my mother was, oddly enough, quite happy about me going to Chobham and doing that job, but she didn't want me away from home, which was why she didn't want me to join the Wrens. And we had a lot of family fights over that. But in the end, I made myself such a nuisance that she said, go, do it.
So, would you be good enough to explain the procedure? You know, having wanting to go in the event, how did you go about this?
Well, I went for an interview in Horn Lane, Acton. And the boy that I later married took me because he said I was such a dimwit I wouldn't get there without him. So I went there and had the usual sort of medical and aptitude and sort of intelligence and whatever tests. And I was told I would be called up in due course. Well, not called up, because I was a volunteer, obviously. I was never called up. Mm-hmm. But I was told I could go into the Wrens. It would take a few months, and it did. I joined the Wrens 1 month after I was 18, in May 1943.
Do you think being a riveter helped? The fact that you had done more work? I understand, you know, the Navy, of course, is the senior service.
Absolutely.
And
never forget that. Never forget that.
No, I'm reminded of it.
Yes, you are. Yes. No, I don't think the riveting helped at all. I probably don't think the riveting was even mentioned when I went for my interview.
Do you remember much about the interview? And did you sort of gain an impression of what they were looking for in young women? For the Wrens, because it was the senior service still, wasn't
it? Well, they said, why do you want to join the Wrens? And I said, because I like the uniform. So I didn't say I want to do my bit for my country, which I should have said. I just said I like the uniform, and they smiled and said, oh, how nice. But that was it.
And so when you were called up, when you received, you know, your orders,
yes.
What was the sort of the stages of procedure after that?
Well, I was given a railway voucher and told to report to Westcliff-on-Sea, which I did. Bearing in mind the first time I'd ever been away from home, this was. And I got to Westcliff-on-Sea, and we were probationary Wrens for a fortnight. We didn't have uniforms. We had things called bluettes, which were sort of like an all-in-one blue dress for probationary Wrens. And after a fortnight, we got our uniforms. We had to go to a naval store called, in the Navy, Slops. Why it was called Slops, I've never discovered, but it was called Slops, and we were issued with our uniforms there. And, of course, we were very proud. We put them on and went out the first night in town and in Westcliff-on-Sea to sport our uniforms and be sort of make people aware that we were in the Navy.
Can you remember now what your uniform consisted of?
Yes, I can. A black plain skirt. Well, it was either dark navy blue, not black, but very dark. And a rather smart jacket. You actually, you're drinking from a mug that shows the uniform. which came from your museum. And a rather nice hat. By that time, they'd changed the hat from a pudding basin to a nice little jaunty Wren's hat with HMS on it. And a white shirt and a black tie and black Lyle stockings. Later, when the Americans came over, we all wore black nylons, which was a lot nicer. And black flat-heeled shoes. And that's about all. A very plain uniform. And I was quite a chubby teenager, so it was quite slimline for me. Made me look slightly slimmer than I was.
Did they also supply underwear and nightwear?
Yes, they did, which we never wore. But I gather some girls cut up their knickers and made them into tops by cutting out the gusset and putting it over their heads. But I never did that. I never sank that low. But as I say, we didn't like the black Lyle stockings very much. It reminded us too much of school.
So after that, were you given your trade, or did you have any choice with your trade?
Yes, there is a general trade in the Royal Navy for Wrens called messenger, which means you go anywhere and do anything. It's called a messenger, and I was a messenger throughout my 3 years, but I did all sorts of different things.
Quite an interesting trade, I would think, if you're sent on different...
Yes, it was. Yes. A lot of variation. Yes, it was good. Yes. Mm.
So, having become a messenger, were you given then further training? For instance, I was wondering about naval tradition, if you were taught much about that.
Well, yes, we were told never to refer to the ceiling or the floor. It was always the deck or the bulkhead. And our rooms we slept in were called cabins. And if we went on leave, we were going ashore, although we weren't literally going ashore, but that was what it was termed. Yes, we had to learn all the naval things, like if you were told off, you were getting a bottle, which goes back to Nelson's times, actually. That was in Nelson's times, you got a bottle if you were told off. But you didn't get the bottle, but it was called a bottle. It was getting a bottle. And if you wanted extra food, you went for the gash. And if you were a greedy girl, which I was, you were called a gannet. The gannets all went for the gash. I used to eat an awful lot in the Wrens. Well, I suppose I was still a growing girl, really. Yes. But, yes, we learned all the naval terminology. Absolutely. Yes.
And being a messenger, was there any particular training for that?
No, there wasn't, because it really meant you could go anywhere and do anything. There wasn't any training for that. No.
So could I ask you now about your first posting?
Ah, my first posting. Well, my first posting was to Felixstowe from Westcliff-on-Sea, where I'd done my probationary Wren bit. And three Wren officers came one day and said to about 20 or 30 of us, I want four volunteers for a dangerous job. And I thought, wow, a dangerous job. I could picture myself being parachuted into France almost. Or at least doing something really, you know, in the front line. And I went and volunteered, as all of us did. We all went and volunteered. We all thought, how great, we're doing a dangerous job. And we weren't told what the dangerous job was at all, really, or even where it was. But when I came out from the line of volunteers, one of the girls said to me, oh, you didn't sound very keen. So I attached myself to the end of the queue, went back and said, look, ma'am, my friend said I didn't sound very keen, but I am very keen indeed. Anyway, we were all told to go away and come back at 600 hours. We learned how to say naval time in hours rather than, you know, by the clock. And we came back, and I was one of the four volunteers chosen. So we then, in a couple of days, we entrained to Felixstowe, where we went to the Suffolk Convalescent Home on the front, which was the Wren's quarters. And we didn't know what job we were going to do. The girls there obviously were doing it, but they weren't telling us anything. And then we were mustered in the morning. Mustered, you see, again comes that naval expression, mustered in the morning, and told that we were going to go out to Bawdsey Golf Club, which was about 2 or 3 miles away, and assemble large balloons with hydrogen and attach rather nasty devices to them. and send them over the North Sea to Germany when the wind was in the right direction. And we were quite aghast, really. We thought, good heavens, what an extraordinary thing to be doing. Anyway, we went, and we did it. And I did it for nearly a year after that.
Yeah. Yes. Could you tell me some of the... I think this is relatively unknown, this operation.
Well, it was on the secret list until about 7 or 8 years ago, and then it was released. We actually, as Wrens, didn't know it was called Operation Outward. We just knew it was Boom Defence. But we were told not to tell our parents under any circumstances what we did. And I never told my mother. And I think if I had, she'd have moved heaven and earth to get me out of the Wrens. But I never told her. And she never, well, she knew after the war, of course, but not until then.
I wondered, would it be possible for you to describe, and this, of course, is from your own experience, the full process of these balloons, you know, how they were assembled, when you got them, what you had to do, with a few examples of some of these things you had to launch them with to do damage.
Yes, I will. We assembled the balloons in Butlin's holiday camp in Felixstowe, and they were white latex rubber and were about, not inflated, about this size. I'm showing you with my hands, about that size.
Yes, about 2 foot square, really. Is it
so you're two and a half foot
yes.
Round, not square.
Round balloons. Yes, across.
But
yes. Diameter.
They had a neck, as balloons do, which had a pip setting on it and a handle, a webbing handle, where you could, when the balloon was inflated, you could hold onto it and take it out to the dispersal point. And then the balloons were taken then to Broadsea Golf Course, and we were given them, and we had the RAF regiment with trailer lorries of hydrogen, which, looking back, I think was quite dangerous, really. They didn't do anything at all except couple and uncouple the hoses on these canisters. And we used to inflate them in three-sided tents made of canvas. And as they got bigger, they got nearer to the side of the tents, and we had to have a bucket and a stirrup pump and spray them. And having seen a few girls with flash burns from these things causing friction, I was very careful to really drench my balloons. So I never got badly burned. A couple of times I had my hair singed from other people's balloons that went off nearby. But my balloons were always good and wet and didn't go up in flames. And then we would take them by their handles out to halfway to dispersal point, where we would attach either 300 feet of wire to mess up electric pylons and things in Germany, or things called socks, which were canvas with a fuse in them, which on arrival in Germany they detonated and set fire to maybe crops and annoyed cattle, that sort of thing. And then we had rather nasty six packs of bottles with phosphorus, water and latex rubber in. And you really didn't want to drop those because you couldn't put the phosphorus fire out if you did. And it got on your skin, of course. And some girls did get hurt by these. But that was another thing. And also cans of what we called jelly, which was petrol with a fuse on the top. A big can, about 18 inches long and maybe 9 inches wide, with the fuse on the top, which detonated on arrival and set fire to things. I think those were the only things we attached, actually. Yes.
It sounds
all pretty lethal.
It's a very skilled job.
Well, you sort of learned how to do it, and after you'd done the first one, it came as second nature to you to do it. You know.
Would you be doing these round the clock, you know, or would they be doing...
No, only when the wind was in the right direction for Germany, which, as I will tell you later, wasn't always. But, no, and then you would take them from halfway to dispersal, out to dispersal, and on very windy days on the East Coast, these damn balloons... You'd be hanging onto them and you'd jump off a bunker and sail. You were airborne for a couple of seconds and you took them out to this dispersal point And if the wind was bad, the balloons would be going from left to right and hitting the ground, and you'd be sort of going with them, and you'd be quite pleased to let them go when you've got to dispersal points. And they'd go off into the sky. And as I remember, I was there in the late spring and early summer and summer. They looked like acres of white pearls going up into a blue sky. They were absolutely lovely. They looked so pretty. Yes, it was fascinating, really, in a way. And, of course, we were taught to man the guns to defend the site as well. We had Lewis guns and rifles. I never fired a Lewis gun, and I do know a girl now called Di Orton who's deaf through firing Lewis guns. But I had a rifle and was taught to use a rifle.
Mm-hmm. So you were really responsible for your own protection, were
yes,
you?
Yes, we were.
Your own security.
Yes, we were. Yes, I don't know if the RAF regiment bore arms then. I don't think they did, actually. I think we were left to do it ourselves. There were 140 Wrens and three Wren officers, a naval captain who we were all in great awe of and terrified of, because he was a grumbly old man. He used to come out onto the golf course sometimes and hurl orders about. And, of course, we had a lot of unloading to do from lorries, and we used to form chains and pass these things from one to another along the chains. So we were always busy, and we didn't wear Wren uniform for this. We wore bell-bottoms, square rig, and navy jerseys. We were the only other category besides boat's crew who wore a white lanyard. But we weren't really allowed to wear our white lanyards on our uniform outside, on what we called our number one uniforms. We were only allowed to wear them when we were operating.
End of reel one, Mrs. Tony Porter. Mrs. Tony Porter, reel two. Yes, so how many of these would you say went off per day or per week? Could you give some idea?
But depending on the wind, I think I've got a figure somewhere on a piece of paper, which I'll try not to rattle, saying how many balloons we actually did send off. 99,142 balloons were launched against the enemy. Of these, 45,599 carried trailing wires and 53,543 incendiary devices. Six naval officers and Royal Marine officers, seven Wren officers, 80 Royal Marines, and 140 Wrens were employed. It says nothing about the RAF regiment. But that's it. Oh, and the equipment expended cost was approximately £220,000, which was very cheap, really, wasn't it? The Air Force didn't like us, by the way, and the 8th Air Force didn't like us either, because they used to fly into our balloons sometimes, and they weren't best pleased, as you can imagine.
I can imagine, though, you were really fulfilling tasks which might have saved them some dangerous missions.
I don't think they saw it that way.
Do you think you probably did?
Well, no, I think probably we were a nuisance to them. I don't think we were saving them much.
Did your husband think that? The man you eventually married? Did he have anything
to say? I don't think I ever told him about my balloons. I was sworn to secrecy. I don't think he knew anything about it. And after the war, we got married, and I don't think we talked about our war service, either of us, although he stayed in the RAF.
So I presumably then the pilots of the Americans and the British, the RAF, wouldn't have known what these were all about.
Well, I think they probably found out what they were about, but I shouldn't think they found out what they were about until they'd seen them. You know, the first time, they must have come as quite a shock, I should think, these... Because they were, when they were inflated, they were huge. They were really big. And apparently when they go up into the atmosphere, with the atmosphere, they get even bigger. They expand a bit. So they'd be 8 to 10 feet circumference when they were up in the air.
So if you were on duty when the wind was right, you know, for Europe, how many could be sent off in a day?
Oh, hundreds. Yes, hundreds, literally. Yes.
By this team of wrens, which are only a small team from what you said, 140. Yes.
And they were in two watches, port and starboard watch. So only half of them would be operating at one given time. We used to be able to tell in the morning if we were operating because there were barrage balloons anchored to ships off Felixstowe coast. And if the barrage balloons had their triple tails out to sea, we knew we were operating. And if they weren't, we knew we weren't operating. And when we weren't operating, we used to go down to Butlin's and make grommets for the nets that went over the boom, which is, I think, why we were loosely called boom defence. And we used to make these big metal grommets. None of us had any fingernails for weeks after we did this.
Yes, that was
the hardest part of the job, actually, making the grommets.
Grommets, are they?
Grommets. They're big, round circles of interlaced wire that hang interlaced over harbours to stop submarines coming in. It's called boom defence, which is what we were called as well.
But known afterwards, you heard afterwards it was called Operation Outward, is that right?
I only heard 7 or 8 years ago that it was called Operation Outward, when these papers that I'm holding came out from wherever they come from, secret files. Confidential operational duties, boom defence, stationed in HMS Beehive, Felixstowe, Suffolk. That's what the pieces of paper are headed. Mm-hmm. I can't imagine now, looking back as teenagers, why we didn't tell somebody something. But we didn't. I think we signed secret acts, and I think we thought that was... we shouldn't tell anybody. I know I certainly never told my mother, and I certainly never told any of my friends.
So seeing these balloons fly off, like, as you described so beautifully, pearls
they
in the sky.
They were like pearls, yes.
Did you have any idea of the success of your operation?
Yes, I'll refer to this paper again, if I may, with trying not to rattle it. And I'll get to the page that says results. Graphs of German disturbances, interesting in particular, 42 to 43. Reports from France. Balloon sighted in Hamburg. Balloon sighted in Hungary. Balloons sighted in Luftgau 11, Hamburg, with phosphorus bombs on them. Balloon sighted in Baden, Sweden, Switzerland and Denmark. Swiss warned, these balloons are filled with hydrogen and it is dangerous to approach them with a burning match or a cigarette. Bulgarian radio put off the air by fire balloons. Excellent drawing and description in French of a captured balloon in August 42. Phosphorus bomb fire, Cornfield, 25th of August 1942. Grass, two gendarmes chased balloon 2 hours across forests and mountains before securing it, phosphorus attached. Another excellent description of our wire-towing balloons from Germany. The report says damage to high-tension cables has taken place over the whole of Germany. Well, that was pretty good, wasn't it? Phosphorus bombs in Limoges, also in Vizy, in France. Cable damage in Charente, the Loire, Vienna. That sounds a bit dicey, Vienna, and France. Farms and houses burnt in Havas near Limoges. Electric current cut off in a large area of Denmark and incendiaries in Jutland. Intercepted communication, Germans instruct aircraft to take off to shoot down balloons. I'll go to the next page. I hope this isn't getting too boring.
No, it's very good to have this information.
It is, really. New bomb worries Germans. Daily Express, 1942, Britain using new firebomb. Daily Digest of World Broadcasts, a number of incendiary balloons over France, one set fire to a granary and to crops, damaged 500,000 francs. Daily Telegraph, 18th of September, 42, balloons over Hungary. Daily Sketch, 18th of September, balloons carrying explosives over Hungary and grain and flax burnt in Belgium. Evening Standard, leaflets by balloons. Now, I don't ever remember attaching leaflets, but apparently someone did at some time, probably before my time. And Daily Telegraph, 4th of August, balloons damage power plant at Mühlhauser. And not only the enemy, now we come to a rather nasty part. War damage claims came from Bristol, Bournemouth and Dorchester. On the 28th of June 1943, I can understand Colchester, Harwich and Frinton. And did we really hit the railways, delaying the Harwich to Frinton train by 24 hours? Well, I don't know, but I did once see the balloons come back in over our heads and head for the Midlands when the wind changed. Now, the best thing we did, or the worst, depending how you look at it, was, let me read from this, quite apart from countless minor incidents, the balloons destroyed the power station at Bolin, about the size of the Battersea Power Station, which was assessed by the senior technical officer in non-technical language as being about equivalent to the loss of a big ship. So we really did hit home that time. Otherwise, I think, you know, it was all little things, little nuisances, really. But
would this have been the only station in the UK that you knew of?
No, there was one at Deal in Kent, but I knew nothing about it. I just knew there was a boom defence station at Deal. I think it was a lot smaller than ours. I think ours was the main one.
And did you know anything about the boom defence itself? You know, apart from doing the grommets?
No, nothing at all, except that they were used as anti-submarine nets, really.
I suppose that part of Britain was very important in the war, given its proximity to Europe.
Felixstowe was mothballed. It was...